Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations on a Friday. I'd like to begin today with a moment's silence, just for fun, for something different, but I can't, because the technology in the ABC's basement that takes this signal and projects it out on the radio, it's got this little special automatic fallback switch so that if it detects silence for longer than 20 seconds or so, this instrumental surf music will kick in until normal broadcasting can be resumed. It's actually very hard these days to create a space for silence, and maybe that's because a lot of people just don't like it, or they're worried that they'll be bored being left alone with their thoughts. My guest today is a man who loves living in silence for huge stretches at a time. His name is Father John Riley, and he's a Jesuit priest. John Riley took his vows of poverty, celibacy, and obedience more than 60 years ago. He taught in Kolkata, he studied under the shadow of Mount Everest, and he even survived typhoid with the prayers of Mother Teresa herself. These days, Father John Riley holds spiritual retreats for people where you spend 30 days without speaking to anyone, and you're given time for the distractions of life to just fall away and all those nagging inner voices that demand petty gratification to subside. And now I'm going to ask him to talk for a whole hour. Father John Riley, welcome to Conversations.
Lovely to be here, Richard.
We were just chatting before we were on air about, we're both in the business of conversations, but yours are necessarily a little more private than mine.
Yes, we're both in the business of conversation. Whereas I was saying, I do a lot more listening than I do talking, which I think is a good rule for conversation. I said to you just before we went online that God gave us two ears and only one mouth. And
it's the internet.
Yes. But my conversation is different from yours because your conversation is public. Everybody can listen to it. But my conversation is always confidential because people are talking about their interiority, people talking about their vulnerability, talking very private things. And if confidentiality were not there, people would not have that freedom. And we all need that freedom sometimes.
When you're having those conversations, obviously it's good for everyone if you get that person who's come to you for that conversation to get whatever it is off their chest. How do you do that? I wouldn't mind some tips, actually. Do you dance around it a little while, or do you sort of try to get straight into and set the tone right off the bat?
Well, I make sure they're comfortable, and I do that normally when I come into the room with them. I have two or three chairs in the room, and I ask them, where would you like to sit? So they choose where to sit. And that already gives them a sense of being at home. And then I'll choose the chair that they don't choose. And I have a hard chair with a straight back for older people who have bad backs perhaps, and then a nice comfortable chair where they can relax more. So I normally have three chairs in a room.
What a lovely idea. Pam's my producer. We'll have to get some more chairs in here, Pam. I think that's a tremendous idea. That's lovely.
Yeah. So in other words, you put them in charge of the conversation, if you can, right at the beginning. And then my first question usually is, well, why did you ask to see me? And sometimes they'll go straight into the reason. Other times they'll beat around the bush a bit. Or sometimes you'll get a person who can't talk at all. They're feeling very nervous. What do I do in that case?
Do you step right back, or do you try and let them fill the space?
I try and let them fill the space. See, some people need a longer space after somebody else is talking before they start to talk. And that's particularly true when people are talking about very deep and personal things, especially if I'm dealing with people who are deeply wounded. So they come feeling or suicidal sometimes. Not that everybody who comes to me is suicidal. I mean, usually it's on a more positive topic that they come, something they want to move forward. But for many people, it's healing the past.
Do you find if that person if they've said what it is and they've put a name to it, that helps a lot?
Yes, yes, often. I've been with some people and they've been with me for half an hour, 45 minutes it might have been. I may have said no more than 50 words in that whole time, in, say, two or three sentences, and they've been talking the whole time. And at the end of the time, they said, "Oh, John, you have helped me so much."
And you've hardly said a word.
I've hardly said a word. But I've been watching them all the time. I've been watching, especially their body language. I've been reacting facially, I'm sure. It's a kind of, well, I call it creative listening. You do it. You do it. I've heard you on your program sometimes. In other words, you free people to say things they didn't know how to say or didn't even want to say.
They then can come to you with good news at some point, I'd hope,
as
well.
Oh, yes. Oh, I mean, my estimation of the human race is continually going up.
Really?
From me, oh, yes. I mean, there is such goodness in people. Now, so, as I said, I'm often dealing with very wounded people. Perhaps I'm dealing with only good people come to me. But no, I've had other people who I would say, well, there's a lot of evil in them. But there's no such thing as a person who is totally evil. At least I don't believe so. I haven't experienced one. There is something there in them which has perhaps been closed down by other people or by hurts in their past life. And they need to be able to talk about that and own it, not deny it. I mean, your past is real. That's there. You can't change the past. The only thing you can change is the present, really. The past is a memory. The future is a hope. And the strange thing is, we human beings can only live the present in one moment. Now, some of the Eastern mystics, and some Christian mystics too, have tried to stay in the present, to look, just stay in the present moment.
That's very hard.
You can't do it. But as humans, we have to keep moving. So it's moment. We live our life in moments. And that present moment, the beginning of our conversation, is already a memory. And what we're going to do for the rest of this hour, I'm not sure. But
I've got a couple of ideas.
So we only have a moment where we really are in control.
I'm interested in your earlier remark that your estimation of the human race is going up all the time, which is really, really quite a lovely thing. Because although in my intro I mentioned that you conduct these retreats, you're quite a worldly man as well, in the sense that you've lived in the world and seen things that many people wouldn't get to see. And I'll come to that. But let's first of all talk about these retreats. What actually happens on these retreats? If someone comes along to this, what do they experience?
Well, normally I would not recommend a person do 30 days of retreat or 30 weeks if they do it in their daily lives. That's within the context of their ongoing lives and relationships with others, and their work goes on as normal. But and of course there you haven't got the same atmosphere of silence in a 30-week retreat. You have 30 days. But I would only recommend a person does 30 days of retreat. That is the full spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola. That's why I called Ignatian 30-day retreats. If they have already done previous retreats of 1 or 2 days or three or four days or perhaps a week, because they need to be able to test themselves to see if they can live in a silent atmosphere in a positive way and not just feel cut off from the rest of the world because they're in silence and solitude.
Where do you take people? Is it a monastery of some kind or is it...
No, it's a spirituality centre. It used to be called the Cenacle Retreat Centre, run by Cenacle sisters who set this retreat centre up, or spirituality centre, in 1984, June of 1984, on land which they had bought from the Carmelites. Now, the Carmelites, about 20 Carmelite sisters who are our next-door neighbours.
Famously silent order.
That's right.
So once you're in this retreat, there's no television?
No radio? There's no television, no telephone, no radio, except in exceptional circumstances. But normally, if somebody needs to communicate with the person, say a relative has suddenly died or something during the retreat, that would come through the director of the retreat.
And what commonly happens once, I imagine once, with the first couple of days, there's a bit of a speed bump to get over as you have to get used to your own company.
Oh, yes, there's a real speed bump. I mean, even people who have spent 1 or 2 days in silence, when they come, the first 2 or 3 days, they feel the silence is oppressive. They've got to talk to somebody. So what you do there is you tell them to come and talk with the director. See, in these 30-day retreats, they do meet with the director once a day. The process is very simple, the process of Ignatian retreat. It is prolonged personal prayer. It is reflection and evaluation of the day and linking the prayer very much with what happened outside the prayer, meals and perhaps walking around in the forest and taking exercise, sleeping or whatever it is. So relating their day with the prayer. Now, if they did it in 30 weeks in daily life, that becomes extremely important, to relate the prayer, which they would do each day, with the events of their life. And then the third thing is the conversation. So prayer, reflection or evaluation, and conversation. This is the dynamic, very simple, of Ignatian retreats of whatever length they are.
Psychologically, what happens as the time goes by? Do you have this sense? I have never done anything like this, and I don't know. I'm imagining what it would be like. Please tell me if I'm wrong. Is that it'd be like that sense of, I don't know, going underwater and hearing the noise of the world sort of subside into a kind of a distant rumble.
Well, as I like to often to say to people who make retreats, you're only in retreat when you feel the silence is linking you with other people. As long as you feel you're being cut off by silence, you're not in retreat. And normally it takes people 2 or 3 days to begin to experience if there are other people in the house. Often there are a group of people making silent retreats together, but they're all making the retreat silently with either the same director or with different directors if there's a large group. And they begin to experience a bonding with the people whom they're not talking to in any way, not even by body language. Now why is this silence so important for Ignatian retreat? It's not meant to be a penance. It's not meant to be sort of buying God's favours.
It's not an ordeal, in other words.
It's not an. It may be an ordeal for the first couple of days if you're not used to it.
But it's not intended to be an ordeal either.
Yes.
Is it a little dangerous, though, for people who might not be in psychologically good shape?
Oh, yes, it can be.
Can they unravel a bit?
See, the silence is not an end in itself. Silence is an aim to get interior silence, where people can become more aware of what they really desire, what they really fear, become more aware of the way they relate to other people, become more and more aware of what are their goals in life, what are they really wanting in life. Everybody wants something more. That's part of being human. Now, what is the more you want? Is it more money? Is it more fame and prestige? Is it more power? I mean, there's a spirituality of everything. Spirituality of politics, of economics. Everybody has an interior life. Often they won't pay much attention to it. But it's there, and it's the source of what they do, ultimately.
Father John Riley is my guest, Jesuit priest. Let's talk about your background. You were born in 1928. Do you remember the Great Depression?
I do, yes, because I would have been probably just coming into my first consciousness. I can remember what they call sustenance workers on the roads. I grew up in the great city of Essendon, home of great footballers, the Bombers.
Allegedly.
I lived in the same street as the Bombers. Their football ground, Windy Hill, was at the top of the street. Mm. I was at the bottom of the street, number one, Nicholson Street, I grew up. But I can remember the sustenance workers who were paid in kind, working on the roads outside our house where we lived.
Family life was happy for you, wasn't it?
Oh, extremely happy. I was so fortunate. I had a wonderfully happy family. I was only in the family for 18 years, and I was the first one to leave the nest. I was the eldest of 3 children, a younger sister 2 years younger than me, and a younger brother who was 7 years younger than me. My father and my younger brother and sister all had red hair. Well, I had, I got no hair now. We were a very happy family.
And you have a really lovely and quite a powerful memory of fishing in the Mornington Peninsula with your dad.
Oh, yes,
during
yes.
the summer. Tell me that.
Oh, yes. Well, the family used to go away for holidays every year for 3 weeks. My father used, who was a professional photographer and eventually became a press photographer, great sporting photographer, Gerard Riley, used to take wonderful pictures of horses on their nose, so much so that the jockeys, when they saw my father at a steeplechase fence or at a hurdles, they would quiver because they knew one of them was going to fall, because he'd always get these pictures, single-shot pictures, this is back in the early days, of a horse falling and, of course, the jockey coming off too. And he was also a great sporting photographer in AFL football especially and cricket. But my father, who was a professional photographer, used to complain about having to take pictures all the week. But when he came home at the weekends or on Sundays, he'd spend the whole day taking pictures of the family. But he said it's different taking pictures of the family. But yes, the story of my father. That we used to go on holidays 3 weeks every year. My father used to arrange his holidays. And we'd go down on the Mornington Peninsula in Melbourne. And my father used to love to go flounder spearing. Now, flounders are these flat fish that lie in the sand, and all you can see is their two eyes. You can't see the shape of the fish. And he used to go out at night flounder spearing with a torch. He'd have a spear and a torch. And I remember when I was 11 years old, I went out with him for the first time. And we went out into this shallow water. It was a place called Rye this time, and the water is shallow. It goes
forever, right? Too. It's Port Phillip Bay, isn't it?
Yes,
it just goes out forever.
Sorrento, yeah. Rosebud, yeah. These places. Well, you can walk out 100 yards and this water could be up to your knees only, or up to your waist at the most. So you'd be looking for the two eyes of these flounders, which would, when you put them on the dinner plate, they would fill the whole plate. We were out there intent on spearing fish, and so a storm came. We hadn't realized the storm was gathering, and thunder and lightning and heavy rain. So we ran into the shore, and I remember there was an upturned boat on the shore leaning up against the bank, and my father and I got under the boat for shelter, and we watched, just the two of us there. I was only 11, and I don't know why I always remember this, but I just felt so close to my father then. I really felt one with him. And he was, you know, enjoying the lightning and the thunder just as I was. And there was something special about that moment. I don't know whether I can explain it fully, but I'm sure everybody has that kind of moment in their life.
I think you've just described it perfectly, actually. And that's just beautiful, watching the storm roll across Port Phillip Bay.
That's what we watched, under the boat with the rain pouring down all around us.
When did you start to feel the vocation to become a priest?
Oh.
So when you was a boy?
I can't remember any time in my life that I didn't want to be a priest, which is strange. Not a Jesuit priest, that came later. I'd never heard anything about the Jesuits until I was 15. But I wanted to be a priest because I thought that's really worthwhile in life. I thought I always had a very strong experience of God being present. Even before I was taught about God, even before I think I had the name God to put on this experience, it was just God was something always there, or someone always there.
So what attracted you to the life of a priest then? Was that the idea of the contemplation or the service?
No, it was... Yes, it was... Well, I thought priests are people who talk about God. They are people who are God people. That's really how I saw a priest. Not just leading people in worship, but helping people to discover God and sort of explore who God really is. And of course, I didn't know who God really is as a little boy. I mean, God was a mystery. God was there in my life all the time. Or this presence. In other words, I never felt alone.
Did you share that thought with your parents, or was it a lovely secret you kept to yourself?
I don't know. It wasn't certainly a secret I kept to myself, but I'm not sure that I talked to my parents about it. My parents were not overly religious people. We was a Catholic family, and we'd go to church, Mass every Sunday. My mother was very matter-of-fact. My father would perhaps be more religious than my mother. No, they talked about God. They encouraged us to pray. I used to pray to God at night, and my way of praying was to recite prayers like the Lord's Prayer or Hail Mary or any other prayer I could learn. My saying prayers was different from this ongoing experience that there was always God. I felt, even as a small boy, I'm not going to live forever, but they say that God is living forever and that I could be living with God forever. And of course, I learned more about these things later on, but that was a little boy. I'd only be 4, 5, 6 years old, I suppose, when... But that,
and these thoughts came into your head.
And I used to pretend to be a priest. All my playmates said, no, we're going to have a mass. So we used to...
So other kids were doing magic shows and you were holding mass, were you?
Well, I was holding mass. I had them all kneeling down, my younger brother wasn't born when I was doing this, I think. Her friends, I'd bring them into mass. And I just remember a few dramatic gestures the priest would make, and I would mumble some words, which I thought was what the priest was saying. But that sort of thing
was
going. So the
definite sense of vocation there from such a young age. Yeah. Well, what about the Jesuits themselves, the Society of Jesus? What was it that caught your eye?
As I said, Jesuits didn't mean anything to me until I was about 15, when for the first time I went with my class from school to do a retreat. And we were a weekend retreat of 2 days, and we were dreading this because they said it has to be in silence, total silence for 2 days, 15-year-old boys. Well, I remember all of us saying, you know, how are we going to find ways of talking to each other and all of that? We can't stand silence. Anyway, we went out to the retreat house on the Friday night, and we were going to stay in retreat until the Sunday afternoon, so 2 nights, and... Of course, like 15-year-old boys, we were sneaking into each other's rooms and having a chat and plotting all sorts of things. But the retreat was going on at the same time. The first time I went out there, it didn't make that much impression. I was overawed at the atmosphere of the house. It was a Jesuit house of studies where young Jesuits were there. And a lot of young Jesuits in the late teens, some of them in early 20s, who were doing their studies in philosophy and attending Melbourne University. So that intrigued me. But I had already met Jesuits before I made the retreat on the sporting field when my school played a Jesuit school, and there was a Jesuit coaching the other team. And I was very impressed by the way he coached and just his general demeanour. And also during cadet camps I grew up a teenager now, World War II, and most of the schools had cadet corps. And on school holidays, they'd go away for a week's camp. Well, there were Jesuit schools close to my school. I went to the Christian Brothers. Wonderful. I have the greatest admiration for Christian Brothers, by the way. I know there's been a lot of flack and everything about them, but I can't speak too highly of the men who educated me, including a Queenslander. A Queenslander used to tell us, I knew so much about Queenslander. But anyhow, coming back, I've lost my...
No, it's right. We were just talking about what was it that attracted you to the Jesuits in particular.
Oh, yeah.
So what does that mean then to become a Jesuit priest? You made a decision to join the priesthood, but you can't become a Jesuit straight away, can you?
No. Well, I start to read a few things about these Jesuits. And I remember going back the next year when the thought came to me, why don't you become a Jesuit priest? And first of all, Jesuit priest has to study for a long time. Sometimes it's 15, 16 years before they're ordained. In my case, it was 17 years. I'm a bit of a slow learner. And took me 17 years as a Jesuit before I was ordained a priest. And also, Jesuits could be sent anywhere in the world. And I wanted to stay in Australia. I mean, I'm an Australian through and through. My parents were born in Australia. All my 4 grandparents were born in Australia, which was quite...
Wasn't that common in those days, no? Yeah.
Yes. So I fought that. I said, no, I'll be an ordinary priest. I don't want the Jesuit part. The following year, I remember this is the third time I went out there on retreat, and the same thought came to me again because there were Jesuits directing the retreat. I said, why not become a Jesuit? And the more I thought of it, the more I realized I was very suited to what they are asking for as candidates to be Jesuit. I liked study, right? I was a very adaptable sort of person. I got on well with other people easily. I liked being with other people. And these were all the things that they were pointing to.
Well, Jesuits famously like questions as much as they like answers, don't they?
Oh, exactly.
Jesuits will spend a lot of time wondering about propositions like, is God powerful enough to create a stone so heavy he could not lift it? These kinds of questions.
Oh, yes.
And is there an answer to that, by the way?
Well, the questions they're likely to ask Jesuits are more about human experience rather than what God can do or cannot do. That becomes a bit theoretical. But it's true. A question, you know, if it's an honest question, is more important in discovering the interiority of a person than any answer. They can get the answers from books, but it's the questions that people are asking which lead you straight into what's really going on inside a person, providing they're honest in their questioning. So that's one reason why Jesuits, I think, are interested in questions more than answers. It's much more revealing of who a person is by the questions they ask.
I feel like we should swap roles, given that's your specialty.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest on Conversations this Friday is Father John Riley, a man who's been a priest for some 60-odd years. Father John conducts regular retreats where he takes groups of people away for days and days and days to spend time, mostly in silence and reflection. John, what did your mum say when you told her you wanted to become a Jesuit priest?
Well, first of all, she played the devil's advocate. She said, why not be an ordinary priest? She said, a parish priest, and you'll stay in the one place and you won't be sent anywhere in the world, because Jesuits could be sent anywhere. So I said, I gave her the reasons why I want to be a Jesuit priest. I said I felt I was suited for it. I was growing more and more to like study and ready for the long haul. And also I said there's not much danger of being sent outside Australia, because the Australian Jesuits don't have any work in other countries, any foreign missions, as they're called.
Or so you thought at the time, yes.
Yeah. But anyhow, then my mother said to me, she said, was that what you were doing when you were going away on these Sundays? So you were going away on Sunday afternoons and you never told me where you were going. I said, yes, I was going out to visit a Jesuit priest whom I had met, and I wanted to talk about the Jesuit life. And I'd gone out for 2, 3, or perhaps 4 Sunday afternoons. And my mother said, I'm so relieved that that's what you were doing. I thought you had a girlfriend and you weren't sharing it with me. So my mother was relieved in one way that I was going out to discuss my future as a Jesuit priest, even though she felt I should be an ordinary priest, a diocesan priest, as they're called.
How long did, in your training, how long did you have to pray for in one session?
Depend on what stage we're at. When the first 2 years, we would all pray for 1 hour in the morning of meditation. That would be before breakfast in the morning. Before we had Mass, that was followed by Mass for half an hour. And then in the evenings we would pray for half an hour.
Was this all on your knees, praying?
No, we were taught to pray by changing posture, and that was very regulated in my time in the vicariate. We used to pray for an hour every morning. We'd spend the previous night 15 minutes preparing for what we're going to pray about the next day. That was left to our own choice. This is not in retreat. This is outside the retreat, normal routine of 2 years novitiate. So we would pray for 15 minutes kneeling, and then a bell would be rung by the senior novice, right? He'd ring a bell. So I don't know whether he was looking at his watch all the time instead of praying, but anyhow, he had to ring the bell after 15 minutes. And everybody then would stand and pray for 15 minutes standing. And then he'd ring the bell again and we'd all sit for 15 minutes. I remember I was looking forward to the 15 minutes where we sat. And I must confess that sometimes I fell asleep in the 15 minutes and I was woken up by the next bell, which was, again, a quarter of an hour of kneeling. So that was very regulated. But the idea was to get us used to praying in different postures.
So you undertook your vows, and contrary to your expectations, you were indeed sent overseas.
Oh, yes.
To India.
We took our vows, which are vows for life, the Jesuits, but conditional on the part of the order. So it's a bit of a Jesuit trick. You know, if you look up the dictionary and look for the meaning of the word Jesuit, you know what you find?
What?
First meaning, member of a religious order found by Ignatius Loyola in the 16th century. Second meaning, a crafty person. And if you'd, this is Oxford Dictionary. You look in the Oxford Dictionary. If you had looked in the Oxford Dictionary about 40, 50 years ago, the second meaning was the first meaning.
First meaning.
Jesuit, crafty and deceitful person.
So what was crafty about your vows?
Well, this, as I'm going to say, it's tricky. Jesuits make, at the end of 2 year novitiate, lifelong commitment, a vow to God of lifelong poverty, which is simplicity of life, celibacy, to live in the unmarried state and yet to remain sane, right, and to remain human, and thirdly, a vow of poverty, which looks like losing your freedom, but actually enhances one's freedom. Now, they're binding on the part who makes the part of the young novice who makes the vows for life. He understands that. But the Jesuits say, but we will not give you full membership until we have seen you go through a period of studies and be ordained a priest and then make final vows, which we will call you to if we think you're suited. And that's when the Society of Jesus binds itself. It took me 20 years before the Society bound itself to me. I was ordained a priest in my 17th year as a Jesuit, but I only became a full member of the Jesuit order when I was called to final vows in my 20th year.
As a man who'd grown up in Depression-era Australia, I imagine nonetheless you weren't quite ready for the poverty in India that you saw when you arrived in Calcutta, as it was then.
No. Oh, that was culture shock. I remember going from the Calcutta airport to the Jesuit College, where I was going to spend my first night in India. It was 1956, January 56. And I was in a taxi. Somebody had come to meet me and another Jesuit who was missioned to India with myself to join the Australian Jesuit mission in Hazaribagh, which is in South Bihar, North India. And looking out the window, you could see these people living on the streets, people everywhere. I mean, it's so different in Australia where you don't see many pedestrians, but in India, pedestrians have right of way all the time. I'm talking about India of, the 50s. This is not 10 years.
Not today, no.
No, this is not
were
yet
you,
10
Were you ready for it? I mean, in any way, did you have any language? Did you?
I had no language. I had no language, but I'd spent quite a bit of time after I knew I was going to India studying the culture of India and learning about it and meeting any Indian people I could find, which were very difficult to find Indians in Australia at that time.
And what was your role? Was it to bring people to the church, or was it to serve the poor?
When I first went to India, I thought it was to bring Christianity to India. I'd only been there a few weeks when I realized that the boot was on the other foot. I had to learn that in the Hindu and Muslim experience of God, there was a lot I had to learn from them about experiencing God and knowing God. So,
did that confuse you for a while?
Oh, yeah, I was very confused because I thought I was there to give. And I began to realize, and as other Jesuits who went to India realized at the time, because there were lots of foreign missionaries in India, a lot of Jesuits, that you had to learn about God and in some way to learn about Christ from people who had never heard of Christ or didn't believe what Christians believe about Christ.
Were you going into a much more religious society than the one you'd left behind?
Yes.
Not the same religion as yours?
That's true. Although Australia in the 1950s is far more religious than it is today. Australia is very secular today. But in India, when I went there in the 50s and more recently when I was working in East Asian countries later on, you go into societies where religion is very important. It's central to people's lives. It's great respect is shown to religion. I mean, here in Australia now, I find religion is something on the margins. I mean, only if you've got a bit of spare time could you get involved with religion. That's the way most people think of religion. I think, somebody once said, in Australia, the whole spiritual dimension, the whole of God, is just a shy hope in the heart, a whisper in the mind. For most Australians, this is God, a shy whisper. It might be true, might be real, but and a whisper in the mind.
Not the same in India.
In India, quite different. I mean, God is on the surface of life in a way that would be hard to imagine somebody brought up in secular Australia.
So I suppose with a strong sense of humility then, you submitted yourself to further learning and study. And you studied at the foot of Mount Everest. Tell me about that time.
I studied up in the in North Bengal in a place called Kurseong, which was just a little bit below Darjeeling. in what were called the foothills of the Himalayas. That was about 5,500 feet above sea level, above Bengal Plains. And then you had Darjeeling. And then out of my window, I could look across and I can see the foothills of the Himalayas. That's 12,000 to 15,000 feet peaks. And behind that, I could see Mount Kanchenjunga outside the window where I studied for 4 years, always covered in snow, 28,000 feet. I'm not quite sure what it is in meters now, but it was all feet those days. And if I climbed up the hill at the back, I could see Mount Everest just to the west.
So you were there and your faith was changing, I suppose, during this time.
Oh, definitely. I went through a kind of faith conversion in my first year up in the Himalayas studying theology. I was studying theology 4 years. I was, 32 years old by the time I started theology. I had already studied and got degrees in philosophy, 3 years, and studied 4 years in Melbourne University. I had degrees in physics and chemistry, specifically genetics. Genetics was just beginning. I was being prepared to be a director of an agricultural institute in India. That didn't happen. When I got to India, they sent me into a school to teach boys, Hindu and Muslim boys, for the senior Cambridge examination. I was teaching physics and mathematics and biology and also teaching some chemistry as well. So I got sidetracked, but that's another story.
During this time, though, very, very sadly for you, you lost members of your family, and you were so far away from them, yeah. John.
I was in the middle of doing the Ignatian spiritual exercises for 30 days in full silence and solitude in my final year of a spiritual formation. I had done the spiritual exercises as a novice my first 2 years as a Jesuit. A Jesuit then does this 30 days retreat in solitude and silence again in his last year before he makes his final vows. That's after ordination. So I was in the middle of that 30-day retreat, which you have normally three repose days in a 30-day retreat. Normally 3 days when a lot of the day you are free to talk with others and that. So it's a kind of a break day. It's part of the retreat, but it's like a continuing the retreat on a day of repose. And my superior came out to me on the first repose day and said to me, "I have some very sad news for you. Your father has died." Now, I didn't know he was that sick. I knew he was sick because he and my mother were planning to come to India for my ordination, but my father had emphysema, mainly through smoking. He smoked a lot and couldn't come, and my mother wouldn't come without him. So that was when my father died. I couldn't go back, and there was no question of going back. This is in 1965.
How did you hear your sister had died?
I was in the middle of Sumatra when my sister died. I had left an address, a contact address. I was working in Indonesia and Malaysia at the time. I'd left a contact address in Jakarta, and then I left another contact address for a week later in Kuala Lumpur. I was going into Sumatra to meet with certain people who had done courses with me in the Philippines, and I wanted to make contact with them. So I was in Sumatra. And I didn't know my sister had died until I got to Kuala Lumpur. When I got to Kuala Lumpur, there were two pieces of mail for me, a telegram from my younger brother and an air letter from my sister. I opened the telegram straight away, of course. I read it so quickly, I misread it. I thought it said my mother had died, who by this time was in her late 60s. And then I read it carefully again. It was my sister, my younger sister, just 41, 42, had died. And
how had she died?
She had died from the after effects of a breast cancer. She had a breast cancer the year before and so had to have a mastectomy.
Did it break your heart being so far away from your family when these things happened?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It hurt. But then I opened the letter. The letter was from my sister, written just 3 days before. I still have that letter.
Did she know she was going to die then?
No, not at all. The day she died, she was supposed to go to work. She worked as a librarian in a newspaper in Melbourne. In the morning, she woke up and said to my mother told me this. She said, "Mum, I've got a terrible headache. I don't think I'll go to work today." And mother said, "Well, look, just relax. I'll ring them up and tell them that you can't come." and take some tablets, which she did. And then an hour or so later, after having a rest on the bed, she said, this headache is becoming worse and worse and worse. So she was starting to vomit too, and very sick. So my mother said, we'd better call the doctor. They couldn't find her own doctor. He was on leave, and so they had to get another doctor. They told this doctor the symptoms. He said, call an ambulance straight away. The ambulance came. The two ambulance people came in. My sister was on the bed. They said, she's dead. My mother got a terrible shock. She
had happened? A cerebral hemorrhage?
Yes, bleeding.
Oh,
as an after effect of the breast cancer.
John, you worked for years in India during the 66 famine, doing work there. And you, while you were in India, tell me how you came down with typhoid.
Oh, I was involved in a famine relief program. It was 1966, where the monsoon had failed in India. India has 4 months of heavy rain called the monsoon.
And that's what the crops rely on entirely, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And I was out in a very remote part of Palermo, in a jungle area, where I lived in an ashram. And I was working among little Christian communities that were scattered around in the forest area, working as forest workers or with small pieces of land where they grew food. Subsistence farmers they were. The monsoon rains came in June, as they normally do, good heavy rains. July, no rain at all. All the paddy fields dried up. They had to find more seed and replant, which they did. Heavy rain in August, everything was going well. No rain in September. So the result was all the crops were destroyed. I found myself living among 1 million starving people. Not only a very few of them were Christians. Most of them were Hindus and Muslims. But poor farmers living mainly in scattered villages in this forest area. So these people had no food, and they didn't realize just how extensive the famine was. So I started to organize famine relief, and the way we did it, twofold. We set up programs to use the food that was coming in from overseas, including Australia, New Zealand, United States, Canada, and we would distribute this. It was a combination of corn and wheat crushed together. We used to call it bulgur, these big bags of bulgur. We arranged programs of food for work. In other words, we wouldn't just give the food to people. We would ask them to work. So each village had to work out what kind of projects, what kind of work they would like to do. Simple earth-moving things, like building wooden fences, mud fences for vegetable gardens, digging wells especially, big wells. We insisted on they dig wide wells, because normally they couldn't afford to dig a wide well. They're just a narrow diameter well and dig straight down to get the water. There's plenty of water underground, about 15, 20 feet. So wide wells. So employ people. And we would pay each worker in kind enough food, some bulgur. I think it was 2.5 kilos of bulgur, with some vitamin tablets, with some milk powder and some vegetable oil to feed the worker and 4 other people, and that would be paid each day.
But of course, at that time, that's when disease runs. And is this when you got typhoid?
Yes, right in the middle of it. A lot of people in a famine die not through starvation, but through lack of
disease
hygiene.
Disease becomes along with it.
So that was another thing we were organising. We were getting people to come in and live in the villages and help people with hygiene. So I was out in a village one day with a doctor, and I started to get a high temperature, or everything. I was feeling terrible pain. The doctor said, look, quickly go back to your ashram. It was a lady doctor. She didn't have was one of Mother Teresa's sisters, actually, who was a doctor. She said, go back to the ashram. If your temperature is above 100, go straight to the hospital. Got back to the ashram. My temperature was 104. So they took me there. I got to the hospital. The doctor diagnosed typhoid fever straight away. I didn't know how serious typhoid fever was, so.
Did you become delirious?
Yes, I remember. I was quite delirious when Mother Teresa, you mentioned, she came to visit me with.
Tell me what happened. What you remember in what must be a delirious memory of that moment.
Well, her sisters were working with with me in famine relief, and Mother Teresa came up to see how they're getting on, and they told her about me, so two of the sisters came to visit me in hospital, and I remember that she was there, and I was semi-delirious, but she said, "Oh, we pray for you," and they prayed for me. I started to get better. At least I thought I was getting better. And after 2 more weeks, I begged the doctor, could I go back? Because the work was just getting organized. It was the beginning. It was the first month of this huge program that we'd set up for Food for Work, being organized through the villages, and this medical program.
So were you well enough to go back to work? You couldn't have been.
She said, "Look, I don't think you're well enough." I said, "Look, I promise I'll go back, and I'll come back as soon as I can." She said, "Well, you go back. But if you start to feel symptoms, if you feel tired, you could come back here straight away." So I went back. I lasted just half a day. And I had to come back. So I had 2 more relapses. I tried to go back a second time after 6 weeks, had another relapse, and then she sent me up to the Himalayas where I had to convalesce.
You thought you were going to be in India for the rest of your life. Tell me why you had to leave.
Oh, that's one of my... one of my Calvary stories, one of my cross stories. Yes, I thought that was the custom in those days. If you went to India as a Jesuit missionary, you would stay your whole life there and under no circumstances come back. Things have changed now. It's quite different. But in those days, no, it was. It was necessary in a way to sink yourself into the culture, learn the language, learn the way, and you become part of the people.
But you had to go.
I had to go. Yeah, well, that's something. I still carry that wound. I had to go, actually. I was expelled by the central government of India. It was, I think, a case of mistaken identity, or somebody in government departments was deliberately lying about me. And the result was I got an expulsion order. It came later, 1 month's notice.
What did they think you'd done?
Well, they said I was forcibly converting people to Christianity by the work I was doing. See, we were working not just with Christians, but a lot of Hindus, Muslims. If they were needed food, we would organize these food for work programs to them also. They said I wouldn't give food to children unless they put crosses around their necks. I didn't know about this because I was, at this time, I had been sent up to the top of the Himalayas there, and I was convalescing. But later on, when I came back, I found out that I had been in the front page of papers all over India for 2 days. And there was one paper at least who was saying, "American spy has been working in famine relief in North India." Now, as I told my American friends, I didn't mind being called a spy, but to be called an American spy, that really hurt. So anyhow, the wheels of the bureaucracy went on.
So that must have broken your heart to have to leave India after all those times. And
it did.
Under false accusations. A sad business. So returning there, you did plenty of work. You worked as a chaplain at Melbourne University. You spent time in Fiji. And I suppose working where you, again, it was a case of you've in being sent to parts of the world where there is a strong Hindu tradition, as there are amongst the Hindus of Fiji, as they are in India. How do you do that then, just resolve those? You're there to, I suppose, I don't know if preach the Catholic faith is the word, but or introduce people to it. How do you reconcile that with Hindu traditions?
Well, yeah, I didn't go there so much to make people into Catholics, but rather to help the Catholics who were already there. I introduced Indian ways of worshipping, which the year before the church had allowed adaptation to the culture in which the church exists.
That's a tricky line to walk, isn't it? Because it's
a very tricky
you can be
line.
Called a heretic if you're not careful.
Well, I was called, I was called a few things by people because what I was doing, because it was innovation, it was different. But the Indian people loved it. It was their own rituals, their own rites, their own ways of practicing religion, but I'd always thought, no, that's forbidden to Christians. Christians can't use that. They are non-Christian ways. So I got involved in that, and I was sent there for 6 months, but I was asked to stay almost 12 months working among the Indians of Fiji. a very special time in my life then.
Father John Riley, you've had a very, very rich life and a wonderful life. Are you glad for the life you've chosen for yourself?
Oh, it's been wonderful. And it's not what I expected when I became a Jesuit, but it's been a life full of the unexpected surprises. It's been a great life.
It's been great speaking to you today as well. You're quite a remarkable man. Father John Riley, thank you so much for being with me today in Conversation.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.